Hope everybody is doing okay here. It's a pleasure to learn with you. Okay. The truth is that this morning around 6 o'clock, the topic I picked was not this. It was about Sfirat HaOmer and Pesach. But then after looking a little bit more reflectively at the Parsha, I realized that this is very appropriate for us to talk about. Why is that? Because this week's Parsha discusses the second Luchos. Now, we're not going to do this today, because if we spend all our time doing this, we'll never get to what's here. But there's a very, very famous drasha of the Beis HaLevi, the 18th drasha of the Beis HaLevi, that discusses the difference between the first and second Luchos. So does anyone know that drasha, or know what the differences are between the first and second Luchos? Anyone here? Yes. Beautiful. So the drasha of the Beis HaLevi says that, beautiful, that it wasn't just the idea that one says Zachar, one says Shamar, etc., etc. It was a much more sophisticated, significant difference. The 18th drasha of the Beis HaLevi that's found in the Shiloh and Tshuvos of the Beis HaLevi, and that is, when the Jewish people sinned by the golden calf, HaKadosh Baruch Hu realized that they had to play a more active role within the religious experience. So instead of the Jewish people just having the Torah, where all of the Torah was written down, every piece of the Torah was written down, and therefore the Jewish people were like the Aron HaKodesh behind me. They held the Torah. They moved from being the Aron HaKodesh to what we call the Klaf Shel Kedusha, the parchment itself, in which they represented the Torah Shebaal Peh. They represented the oral tradition itself. And they were now part of the Torah process. And the Beis HaLevi proves this through statements in the Gemara, statements in Kabbalah, statements in Medrash, but also proves it from certain differences between the presentation of the first and second Luchos. Maybe you can help me out. What are some of the differences between the first and second Luchos that perhaps celebrate these two different paradigms? Can someone help me out? Yes.
The first Luchos were Maaseh Elohim, and the second ones Moshe had to make himself.
Okay, great. Any other differences? Anyone else? The first Luchos, Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from Har Sinai, even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to him panim el panim. Are we told anything about a change in Moshe's demeanor with the first Luchos? Anything? What about the second Luchos?
His face was shining.
His face was shining. Why, when God speaks to him directly, his face is not shining, but when Moshe Rabbeinu has to write the second Luchos, when Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't speak to God panim el panim, when Moshe Rabbeinu has to wait for God, as opposed to the first Luchos, when Moshe Rabbeinu, God's waiting for Moshe Rabbeinu, why is it that only then is this Karan Or, this radiant light from his face? So the answer is that Moshe Rabbeinu, for the first Luchos, was the messenger boy, bringing it from Shemayim to the Aretz, from heaven to earth. The second Luchos, Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't the messenger boy, he was the message. He was Torah Shebaal Peh. He was the oral tradition. And therefore his face shines to celebrate that difference. Okay? Okay. This idea that the Jewish people play a significant role within the entire notion of Torah process highlights another idea. By the way, therefore an aftergrowth of of the Luchos, according to most Mefarshim, is the Mishkan. The Mishkan is the Jewish people's ability to create a house of God in this world, where the Jewish people can play an active role within the process. By the way, this tension between playing a passive and active role is not only seen by the creation of the Jewish people, by Har Sinai. Where else is it seen? Can someone help me? Where else this role of humankind playing a passive or an active role and failing in their passive role and succeeding in their active role is seen? No. Let's talk about it in the Torah itself. What? Adam HaRishon, creation of humankind. They're given a passive role. That role doesn't really work, even though they can speak to God clearly. It's only when they have to work towards it do they have a chance really to succeed in living in Gan Eden this time Gan Eden being created through their energy and effort instead of just being given to them on a silver platter. An extension of this notion that the Jewish people are now the Torah itself and they represent Torah Shebaal Peh is the prohibition that is found in the end of Devarim of Lo Bashamayim Hi. The Torah is longer in heaven. V'lo me'ever ayam hi, ki karov elecha hadavar ma'od, v'ficha uvavavcha la'asoto. This idea that the Torah is no longer in heaven is highlighted in a host of different, is really an idea of the role of Nevuah, or the role of God within the halachic process. And that's what I thought we would spend together today. Now, there's a lot of sources in front of you, and there's no way in a half an hour or 35 minutes, especially when you guys will hopefully, this will be a dialogue, not a monologue. We're going to get through all of them, but I think that you should have them all. And the ones we don't get to, when you have some spare time, it pays to read them and go through them yourself. Okay? And if you want, I've actually written an article on this that has not yet been published, that's in draft form. If you send me an email, and the email's below here, I'll send you a copy of it, and it gives you around, you know, another 50 to 100 makoros on this issue, and feel free to use it for any papers that you want in college, or, you know, anything else of that nature. If there's a halakhic issue, ask your local Rebbe, but from my perspective, you can quote from it or do anything you want with it. Okay? Just don't send it to tradition or something like that, because I'm sorry, we'll do that. Okay? Okay. Let's open the handout here. You have the famous story of Tanur Achnai. Anyone know the story? Hopefully most of you do. Someone want to share it with me? Tanur Achnai story? Page one, open source one. Tanur Achnai story? Anyone? You ever heard of the story?
You started off.
An argument between the rabbis and Rabbi Elazar regarding a tanur, a certain type of tanur, whether it's makabel tumah or not. Normally, anything that is a kli, anything that could hold liquid in it, like for example, this, okay, can be makabel tumah. Something that cannot hold water is not makabel tumah, or cannot hold liquid is not makabel tumah.
Absorb also?
No, it's not about absorbing as much as the capacity to be a kli kibul, that it can hold something.
So how come
with
sechach we can't use a table or any other wooden thing that is makabel tumah?
Right, so you can't, something that's a kli can't be used for sechach. Something that's a vessel can't be used for sechach.
Because it holds.
Because it can be makabel tumah. You're right, that's the halacha. It can't be something that's a kli kibul, 100%. But it's important to recognize this idea. By the way, because something that's hold, that's makabel tumah is a davar chashiv, it's something important, and tzchach cannot have that status, by the way. What happens if you have an oven? An oven can normally hold water. What happens if the oven is made out of five different pieces, but or whatever, many pieces, but instead of it being cemented together, it's banded together, you know, with a strap. So if I cut that strap, it would just fall apart. Does that be makabel tumah? Not, that's machlokas Rabbi Elazar and the Chachamim. So Rabbi Elazar says that I'm going to prove to you that I'm right. And he says, if I'm right, a carob tree outside the Beis Medrash should uproot itself. And sure enough, I'm paraphrasing. The carob tree uproots itself. And he says, well, so the rabbis say you can't bring a raya from a carob tree. He says, well, if I'm right, the water outside of our Beit Midrash, the water should flow backwards. And the water flows backwards. They say you can't bring a raya from that. He says, if I'm right, the walls of the Beis Medrash should fall in. And what happens is the walls of the Beis Medrash fall in until Rabbi Yeshua gets up. And what does Rabbi Yeshua say? The walls of the Beis Medrash? What? Yeah, don't interfere with an argument amongst the rabbis. And the walls stay crooked. They stop falling down out of respect to the comic Rabbi Yeshua, don't get involved. They don't return to their original status out of respect to Rabbi Elazar. Then he says, if I'm right, that a voice from heaven should come out and say, the halakha's like me. And what happens is, a voice comes out and says, why are you arguing with Rabbi Elazar? The law is like him in all places. Rabbi Yeshua gets up and says, That's fine, but the majority of the rabbis are against Rabbi Elazar. We don't care what God says. Lo v'ashamayim hi. It's no longer in heaven, and therefore we don't passim like Rabbi Elazar. So here's an unbelievable thing. I thought halacha is about truth. And here it seems that despite the fact that God weighs in on the side of Rabbi Elazar, since it's two against the rest, they're the minority, and acharei ravim lahatos, and therefore it doesn't apply to him. What happens is, the end of the Gemara in Source 1 is that Rabbi Nassan turns to Rabbi Eliyahu and says, what was God doing at this time? Amalei. So Rabbi Eliyahu responds, Kachayach, he smiled and said, Netzchuni banai netzchuni, my children have won, my children have won. This famous Gemara, for me one of my most favorite pieces of Gemara, which really highlight the idea of the role of us within the halachic process, that even God, once the principles of the Torah were given to us by HaKadosh Baruch Hu from Shemayim, even God cannot interfere with the halachic process. Let's spend, before we discuss how you feel about that, let's spend a few minutes showing you how this is concretized in a whole bunch of other places in Shas. Let's look at source number 2. Yoshua is told by Moshe Rabbeinu, you know what, I'm about to die, you have any questions to ask me? Yoshua says, Rebbe, you know, I've been in your Beis Medrash all of my life. I have no questions. You've been very clear. Moshe dies. He forgets 3,000 halachas. The Balabatim are, you know, furious at Yoshua, the Jewish lay leaders. They're upset. You know, here we hired this new rabbi to take over from Moshe, and he doesn't know. He forgot 3,000 laws. So they say, why don't you speak to God and get those laws back? And by the way, these are not new laws. It's not like the story of Tanuach Nai. It's laws that are already in the legal system. Yeshua says, I cannot do it. Lo b'shamayim hi. I have to relearn the sugyas and figure it out again, even if my conclusions will be different than they were in the past. Source number 3. Gemara in Arvei Pesachim, v'halacha kedivrei Beis Hillel. The halacha is like Beis Hillel. So the Gemara says, pshita. Why do we need a braisa to teach us that the halacha is like Beis Hillel on how you make kiddush at the seder? The hanafik baskol, there is a baskol that said the halacha is like Beis Hillel. Why do we need a braisa to tell us? There is a baskol. So there's two answers. One answer is the braisa that says it's like Beis Hillel was written kodem baskol, before the baskol. The ibay yaseima. Another answer is la'achar baskol, that the Brisa was written after the Baskol, but what do you need the Brisa for? Everyone knows what a Brisa is? A Brisa is a rabbinic addition, a rabbinic compilation of a dialogue regarding regarding what the halacha is in this case. A Brisa is a later statement after the Mishnah indicating what the halacha is.
So
a baskol is a heavenly voice. Sorry. If I say the acha baskol, Rabbi Shui, the Amar e mashkichim of baskol. You don't listen to a baskol.
But that shows that some people disagree with that.
Ah, so that's isn't that what it shows? What does the word be by yaseima mean? What does be by yaseima mean?
If you want.
So if you interpret it the way you just did, then you're right. However, the Ibayis Ema means, according to most people, that this is the second and more preferred answer. How do I know that's the case? That the Ibayis Ema means that it's the second and most preferred answer? I know that because in the Shevod Uchuvot of the Marshal, at that simon, it defines that. That's why I give you that in English. And in Encyclopedia Talmudit, Volume 9, Chapter 31, Page 330, footnote, Halacha, there's a plethora of sources that say the Ibayis Ema is the more preferred answer. Now that you know that, why don't you say why is the second answer the more preferred answer? No? I know, but what is it teaching you? Why? I know that the Ibayis Ema now means the preferred answer. Why is it the preferred answer? What's it teaching you? What? That you cannot rely on the baskol. That a baskol does not play a role within the halachic process.
That's
That's the final answer. That's the more prevalent answer. You might think that you can, as was stated just before so beautifully, you can, if you want to hold by a baskol, you can. If you don't want to, you don't have to. Therefore, you needed a brisa because those who don't hold like a baskol won't hold like a baskol. No, it's ve'i bayasema. The final answer of the Gemara is ve'i bayasema. That is the preferred answer, that we don't hold like a baskol in the halakhic process. Okay?
And it still says pshita in the Havanah.
Pshita, the Hanafic Basco, Pshita,
so
you know, why do you need to tell us the Hanafic, because it was a Basco, so you're right, so the Havamina is that maybe you should be able to use a Basco, because it's truth, but the Maskana is, you can't use a Basco. This idea of the use of the role of a Kaddish Baruch Hu was highlighted in source number 4, where David HaMelech asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu whether he should go to a war or not, and the Gemara says you shouldn't be asking HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you should ask the Beis Din of Shmuel, and the answer is he really did ask the Beis Din of Shmuel. Shmuel said he had to go to a war, he knew he had to fight the war, he just wanted to know if he was going to win the war or not. This was a war against terrorism, he wanted to know if he was going to win it or not. He knew he had to fight it, he just wasn't sure if he was going to win it. Turn to the next page, source number 5. The Rambam tells us that you're not allowed to, lo bashamayim hi, a navi cannot teach you a new halacha. But yet, there seems to be times in which we see in the Torah that forms of divine intervention are used. Look at source 6. Can you tell me what issue I'm talking about there? Source 6? The Goro of the Chalukah. Well, can you explain it a little bit more?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I know it's there, but just can you explain it a little bit more?
Yes,
I even translated it. I mean, I didn't translate it. I copied the translation. There are other parts of this that I personally translated, but that, not that. Go on.
So when Israel came down, they didn't get what? So they had a lottery, and they
So they go to Israel, and there is this lottery, and the lottery set, and the lottery is all done with Ruach HaKodesh, who gets what? What property you get is a halachic issue, right? So now we see that where Reuven gets, where Shimon gets, where Levi gets, where Yehuda gets, is being done by a divine lottery. How can you do that? So Rav Kook asks a similar question in other things, source number 7. Rav Kook says,
Why is the
chalukah
halachic?
It's because nachla, inheritance, property, is very halachic. What inheritance you have has, you know, plays a role in a whole bunch of halachic issues.
So it doesn't matter which section you get, as long as you have a.
Except what section you get also enables you what type of work you can do and a whole bunch of other things of that nature.
Can't you make a select between the establishment of something versus the upkeep of it?
I'm not sure you can make that chiluk, but Rav Kook makes a different chiluk. That every time the Torah says that divine influence can play a role, divine influence has a buy, so to say. Divine influence is permitted. When the Torah says, Al pi hagorol techaleka aretz, the Torah is saying, yes, there is a law of lo bashamayim. But you should just know there are some things that law doesn't apply to, and I will tell you what those things are in the Torah. And the Torah tells us that when it comes to the Yerusha of Eretz Yisrael, it's done by a lottery. Okay? Now, let's look at source 8 for a second. Source 8. We're going to look at source 8, source 9, source 10, source 11. And hopefully you'll figure out. I'm going to skip a few sources, and because I want to get to some of the punchline stuff also. Source 8 says the following. A guy tragically loses his father. His father left him a pot of gold, but his father did not tell him where the pot of gold is. One night he has a dream, and the father says, you know what? The pot of gold is in the attic, it's in the attic. It's behind this and this shelf. There's 30 coins of gold in that pot. And when you find it, you should just know that all that money is for CJF. and it's not for you to have. He goes up to the thing. It's exactly where he says. It's 30 coins, and the halacha is he does not have to give one penny to CJF. Not one penny. Even though the dream told him exactly where it was, behind which shelf it was, how many coins it was, he does not have to give one penny to CJF. Why not? What? Last time you go on a CJF program. What else?
I mean, he can't. He doesn't have to.
No, he doesn't have to. Right. He can't. He can. He doesn't have to.
It doesn't establish his shame or color shame.
Why not? Why doesn't it establish color shame stucco? Why doesn't it establish... There's a dream. It tells him exactly where it is, whatever it is. Why isn't the money stucco money? Because it's a dream. And your dream is a form of divine, maybe, conversation. And even though it's an accurate conversation, lo bashamayim hi. So even though the dream is totally truthful, halachically, you do not have the responsibility to give that money to tzedaka, because it does not become a status of tzedaka. That's source 8. Source 9 is a Shulchan Aruch that passes that way. We'll read source 9. Im amru b'chalom, elu hamal shehit min avicha, shel tzedaka hein. This is where your father, if he has a dream and says, this is where your father hid the money and it's all of tzedaka, ein o klum, it's nothing to divrei chalomot, lo ma'alim v'lo moridim. Chalomot don't play a role. But here, what about the following? Listen to this thing. He has a dream. He has a dream, and in the dream, he was excommunicated. In the dream, he's excommunicated. Now, normally, if you're excommunicated, you need 10 people to undo the excommunication, and they have to be Talmidei Chachamim, great, wise people. So look at source 10. I'm a Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef says, Niduhu b'chalom. He in a dream he's excommunicated. Sarich yud b'nei adam latir lo. He needs 10 people to help him be to help him lose his excommunication. Behu detanu hilchata. They should know halacha. Avo masnu v'lo tanu lo. V'ileka detanu hilchata filo masnu v'lo tanu. V'ileka lezov lisav. If they don't somebody who knows anything, they should find somebody who just reads Hebrew. And if they don't read Hebrew, and if you can't find 10 people who read Hebrew, you can even use 10 people who don't read Hebrew. Any 10 Jews help you remove the excommunication that he got in a dream. So what's the question that we should be asking ourselves from this Gemara? No? Why is he being excommunicated for? I thought dreams cannot establish a halachic issue. So, can someone answer the question for me? I don't know what that means. I mean, I know what the Hebrew words mean, but I need you to articulate them. Close. The Shiva Tzion, source 12, answers the question. The Shiva Tzion is who, by the way? Does anyone know who the Shiva Tzion is? It's not like I'm asking you a personality in Tanakh. I'm asking you Shiva Tzion is the child of the Noda B'Yehuda. Okay? Rabbi Cheskel Landau's child, I believe his name is Rabbi Shmuel Landau. Right, Rabbi Hoffman? So, Shiva Tzion. So the Shiva Tzion answers the question. You can look at there and think of it yourself. Why, all of a sudden, does this situation have one in which There's lo bashamayim. It seems like it's a violation of lo bashamayim here. Can someone think about that for a second and help me? Look at source 12. Maybe you can answer it by looking at it. Anyone?
Is it a prediction? What's going to happen?
Not really. Anyone? My question is, why is it that a dream, which is not a lot of even suggest after they found the pot of gold, suggests that the money stuck a money, but then there's a dream that the guy was excommunicated, and we take that seriously, not totally seriously, but we take it seriously that he needs 10 people to relieve him of his excommunication.
They don't worry about majority, you know, in case of danger.
They don't. You're saying it right, but you're saying part of it, but you're not saying all of it. In a case of danger,
if you were saying that the person as an individual, the fact that he's having this dream that he's going to be excommunicated is a sign of bad stuff's in store for him, and for himself, he's worried about his own neck. He's going to be willing to be concerned for minority opinion. He'll do whatever he takes to try to alleviate that future, you know, that seems to be coming upon him. It could be not even from a love exam. It could be just to alleviate his own personal fears.
So the answer is exactly that. It's not a halachic issue here. It's that we're afraid for the mental anguish of the individual. That he's in a dream, he was excommunicated. We want to relieve him of that mental anguish. And therefore, he has to go through a process of being relieved of that excommunication, but it's almost a catharsis. It's a relieving thing. It's not a full bona fide halachic process, or else we would have required 10 Talmidei Chachamim. Here we require 10 people in the local YU beginner service. They can do it. Even if they don't read any Hebrew, they don't know any, they can still play that role. The point being that it's not a... It's relieving an anxiety as opposed to a halachic issue.
Why do you have to relieve anxiety?
Because you're concerned about the guy. You're concerned that the guy in the dream is going to have anxiety that he was excommunicated and what that foreshadows for him. You want to help him relieve the anxiety. We see that in other places also. Are you allowed to fast on Shabbat?
No.
What? In one case, you're allowed to fast on Shabbat. Besides Yom Kippur. When you have a dream that something bad is going to happen to you. Why? Why are you allowed to fast? Because we feel you're going to be in pain without fasting, and therefore fasting is your oneg Shabbos. So it's a psychosomatic issue. So if the guy is excommunicated in a dream...
He's being excommunicated for a reason. Why do we care about his anguish?
Oh, he's not really in cherem though, right?
He's not really in cherem.
He's not really excommunicated.
Right. If we care about his anguish if he's excommunicated in real life, not in dream world.
So if he doesn't do it... He doesn't have 10 people. If he doesn't care much about his dream, he doesn't have to have 10 people.
I think the Shulchan Aruch paskins that they want him to have the 10 people. And the fact the Shulchan Aruch says you don't even need 10, 3 would be good enough. The Shulchan Aruch is so concerned about his anxiety, it became a halacha that you had to get relieved from it. But the what?
He doesn't care so much. That's proof that he doesn't need it. If he would care, he would go and get it. But if he is not here to do that, then why should we force him?
Because the Shulchan Aruch many times forces you on issues of health or psychology. For example, you're baking matzahs for Pesach, and you keep water outside of your house, and you forgot to cover it. That water no longer becomes permitted for use to bake matzahs. You're not so worried that a snake's going to come into the pail of water and deposit poison. Nevertheless, the Shulchan Aruch says that it takes concerns for you even in places you don't take concerns. You cannot use that water anymore. There are many times in halacha that we do that. We're going to skip 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. Or actually, we're not going to skip 17. Because 17 and 18 and 19 are very exciting. Here's an unbelievable thing.
18?
Unbelievable thing. 17. 17, 18, and 19 is unbelievable. Here's this unbelievable thing. You guys ready? This is like really interesting here. Someone tell me who wrote the Shulchan Aruch? Rav Yosef?
Cairo.
Where did Rav Yosef Cairo live?
Sfat.
Sfat. Does anyone know what other things Rav Yosef Cairo was involved in? The Sephardic... Major Posek.
Beis Yosef.
He wrote the Beis Yosef. Anything else that the Rav Yosef Cairo was involved in?
Kabbalah.
What type of? How do we know that?
He lived in Sfat.
How do we know that?
He was learning from
the Ari.
He was learning from major Kabbalists. In fact, he had a Magid. some form of divine spirit visit him. And the Shalah of Shlomo Levi Horowitz writes how he was visited by a Magid and that he witnessed it on one Shavuos night. So the bottom line is, and what happened was, Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote a book, a diary of his conversations with this spirit. In that book is called what?
Magid
Misharim. So you have Rabbi Yosef Karo, he's a halachist, perhaps the quintessential halachist within the Jewish tradition, a Sephardic halachist that was even when the Ashkenazim wrote a code that sometimes differs, they did not write their own book. They wrote a appendage on Rabbi Yosef Karo. The Ramah is an appendage on Rabbi Yosef Karo. It's not its own book. Rabbi Yosef Karo is the premier stamp, halachic stamp. And this rabbi, Rabbi Yosef Karo, was also a great Kabbalist, and he wrote a book called the Magid Misharim. So 17 and 18 are two different laws. 17 tells you how many times you have to say Amen and Kaddish, which is like three times you have to say Amen and Kaddish. 18 tells you the following. Look at Sif Gimel of 18. Hamisane Hamachas Barosh Hashanah Tainis Chalom. If someone fasts one day on the first day of Rosh Hashanah Tainis Chalom, Imhaya B'yom HaRishon, if it was on the first day, Tzorech Lashano Shnei Yamim Kol Yamav, the rest of his life on Rosh Hashanah, he has to fast both days. You fast the first day of Rosh Hashanah because you had a dream. You have to fast the second day because it's like one long day. And you have to fast for the rest of your life on Rosh Hashanah. V'imhaya b'yom hasheni, but if you fast on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, Yis'ana kol yomav yom sheni b'vad, you only have to fast on the second day of Rosh Hashanah and not on the first day.
And for the rest of the
years? No, for the rest of the years. Forever, you have to do that. That's what Rabbi Yosef Karo passes in the Shulchan Aruch. Source 19 says the following. Source 19 says that you should know that there's a Siman Chavav of Magid Meisharim. That's Rabbi Yosef Karo's work. Says the following. The Magid's having a conversation with Rabbi Yosef Karo. Rabbi Yosef Karo has a bad dream. The Magid says you should fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah because you had a bad dream. Rabbi Yosef Karo says, I'm not fasting on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Because what's the halacha that I fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah? I have to fast for the rest of my days, on both days of Rosh Hashanah, not just the first day. I'm going to wait till the second day of Rosh Hashanah to fast, because then I only have to fast on the second day of Rosh Hashanah for the rest of my life. The Magid says that's not true. If you fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, you only have to fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah for the rest of your life. That's what the Magid tells him. Rav Yosef Karo is told by a divine spirit, if you fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, you only have to fast on the first day for the rest of your life. How does he and he writes this down. How does he paskin in the Shulchan Aruch? Not like the Kabbalah told him, not like the Magid. It's more than Kabbalah. The Spirit of God told him, this angel, this representative of God. He follows what he thinks the Talmud tells you is the decision. He goes against what the Magid told him, and he follows the halakhic process found in the Gemara. And the second paragraph of 19 says that how many times you have to answer Amen? Not three times, but five times. What does he write in the Shulchan Aruch?
Three
times. So all of a sudden you see that Rabbi Yosef Karo, when he was visited by a divine representative of the heavenly court, would not follow that divine representative. He would follow the halachic process found in the Talmud. He would not allow his interactions with Shamayim to affect his halachic process.
That's supposed to make sense.
What?
That's supposed to make sense.
Well, tell me why it doesn't.
Because obviously humans can err. He's being stubborn to the fact of human fallibility. It doesn't.
And God's telling him.
So we're going to get to that in 1 second. Great question. That, by the way, should be the same question about it doesn't make sense when God came down from heaven. It doesn't make sense either. Turn to the next page. This I wrote the translation on. Okay? This is an introduction to a Kabbalistic sefer called Sifra Detzinuta. The Sifra Detzinuta is written by the Vilna Gaon, and the introduction was written by Rav Chaim Volozhin. All right, Rav Chaim Volozhin. So here is the introduction by Rav Chaim Volozhin. Okay. Rav Chaim Volozhin is speaking about his Rebbe. Who is Rav Chaim Volozhin's Rebbe? What? The Vilna Gaon. Okay? Read this. And more than anything, this is his, Vilna Gaon's greatness and his awesomeness, for he only revealed his soul to feel the goodness which is only felt when it toils with the struggles of wisdom, knowledge, and intelligence. Only after his great struggles for Torah knowledge, and when the heavens had mercy upon him, revealed to him the wellsprings of knowledge known as Radar, the deep secrets, this allowed him to attain the knowledge of Teferet Elokim. However, except for this learning of Kabbalah, his soul was not interested in the angels teaching him Torah. He never allowed the angels that came to him to teach him Torah. He never accepted any of their Torah except when it came to teaching him philosophy. When they, the angels, wanted to tell him from the heavens the pearls of wisdom of the Torah, without him having to struggle and toil, and to be told the secrets up high through the angels who have mastered the mysteries and princesses of Torah, he did not pay attention to them and distance himself from them. For I heard many times from the mouth of the Holy One, the Vilna Gaon, that many times Magidim from the heavens came down and were willing to share with him the secrets of Torah without any need for him to struggle. He did not give his ear, pay attention to them. One of the Magidim was very obstinate. With all this, he did not look at the angel's great vision. He, the Vilna Gaon, answered the angel and said, I do not want my knowledge of God's Torah to be communicated by any type of medium, only what my eyes should be able to perceive, the wisdom of Torah, according to what God wishes to reveal to me through my studies. The Vilna Gaon would kick away any angels that helped him with the halakhic process. That's what Rav Chaim Volozhin writes. And by the way, Rav Chaim Volozhin was known as a rationalist. He doesn't normally write these things. He wasn't known as a Kabbalist. He writes about the Vilna Gaon that when the Vilna Gaon was visited by some type of angels, he would shoo them away because he wanted to figure out the halakhic process himself, even though he could have been wrong because humans make mistakes. So we see there's one exception to the rule, which I'd like to first answer the question before we see the exception to the rule. So let's ask ourselves the question, because we have to bench soon, and we have to finish by 8 o'clock. So let's ask ourselves the following question. Help me and tell me the following thing. Why is it that we have created a law that basically says that a Kaddish Baruch Hu is no longer involved in the halakhic process, to the point where maybe a mistake, human beings are make mistakes. Why is that? Human beings, the Magid Misharim told Rabbi Yosef Karo what to do. He taught things differently. The Vilna Gaon was visited. Rabbi, you have the story with the Chachamim. Why is it that we ignore them? Yes.
Because anyone could come out and say, oh, I got to do God or the angels. People told me that this is the right thing, and you say the wrong thing.
Uh-huh.
So you can't differentiate between
the Vilna Gaon and someone else?
Well, I don't know. A dream is always one person. While all these things are, like, they write down the Torah.
Oh, I think that, you know, if you got all the rabbis, imagine having all the Rosh Hashivas of YU in a room. They're discussing halakhic issue, and they all agree that God is telling them it's a different way, and they don't follow him. They all agree it's God. New. Yes.
It casts a doubt on all that man does create himself. If you're only relying on what Akash Barker puts a stamp of approval on, then it shows a lack of trust in what
okay. I think it's even more than that.
No
but
purpose,
good.
No purpose for man in the world.
In order for us to play a role as God's partners, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to allow us to play a role within this world. Playing that role means that humankind makes a contribution. Once we are given the principles by God of how to orchestrate our contribution, which is what the Torah is, and once we are given the theorems through which how to expound on that Torah from God, part of it being a partnership with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is that now we have a role to play. And what defines that role is the capacity that what is defined as truth and what is right is what we decide is correct using the principles of halacha. The definition of truth is expanded to not only what basically came from this corner of the table, not only what is objective truth, namely that what comes from the divine, but what is subjective truth, which is our approach to Torah using the divine theorems. That itself now becomes truth. Mikadesh Yisrael v'hazmanim. The Jewish people sanctify time. Not because we always sanctified it as accurately as if we had a watch from heaven, but we are partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the halakhic process. Let me finish. Once we are partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the halakhic process, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to move over and allow us to play a role. A role which needs to be so significant that sometimes we tell God, butt out. You gave us the Torah. You gave us the divine theorems, the Yud Gimel Midos, that through which the Torah is Nidreshes Behem. Now it's your turn to take a seat and allow us to continue the process. Because we need to be active partners in the process. When we are active partners in the process, what do we guarantee? Nu, what do we guarantee if we're active partners in the process?
Truth.
More than truth, we guarantee the future of the Jewish people. When we are not active partners in the process, we do not guarantee the future of the Jewish people. In order to guarantee the future of the Jewish people, in order to guarantee the future of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role in this world, we need to be partners in the process. We need to be actors on the stage. And therefore, what?
It doesn't make any sense. I don't understand how you could say that he's God. You could just say, oh.
Except God, when God created the world, he by definition decided, we say it three times a day, the Taken Olam B'Machut Shakai. It's our job to finish the creative process.
So why is he overstepping boundaries? Why is he sending angels down to say, like, oh,
so we can have this conversation. Or maybe I mean, you can answer that on a whole bunch of different levels. You can answer it as if to say that maybe they have a certain amount of independence on their own also. There's a whole bunch. That's a whole different parsha. But and who says God said, again, you have to understand this whole notion of what a maggid is to be able to deal with that. And it could be that a conversation does not mean you always have to accept. You can realize there are multiple truths in the world. But the perspective that needs to be honored here is the fact, and that's why this is such a hard thing to understand for all of us, but I've got to finish this point and then we'll bench, and that is you need to recognize a very important yesod that's being highlighted here. The yesod is that our role is so significant once we really know Torah cold, that we become a Kadosh Baruch Hu's partner. And sometimes in a partnership, one partner has the right, once they've agreed on a common understanding, to assert him or self within the process. Love for you.
This isn't an equal partnership, though.
But the truth is, once a Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Torah, and gave us the rules, then our role within the process becomes in some ways more significant than a Kadosh Baruch Hu's. That's what Lobach Shemayim he is. That's the unbelievable piece. And by the way, what happens? It doesn't mean Chas V'Shalom, God is the one who told us how to do this process. It doesn't mean that any person can get up and say, this is the halacha, I say this is halacha, no one can disagree with me, especially God. It has to be somebody who's a posek, who understands all of Torah, who's gone through the whole process. Right? It's not like, you know, it's not like anybody. But once somebody has reached the level in which they understand those issues, they become a partner with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Partnership with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is what guarantees the future of the Jewish people. That's why the first Luchos didn't work. The first Luchos didn't work because the HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us everything on a silver platter. And Luchos that are totally on a silver platter are Luchos that are destined to fail. The second Luchos, where we are part of the process, is the only Luchos that will succeed. And I need to conclude just with one statement. Let's look back at the first page of our handout. Eliyahu is asked what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is doing when HaKadosh Baruch Hu... By the way, you should just know, my wife does not like this Gemara at all, for all the reasons you said. And that's why I think this is one of the nicest pieces of Gemara for all the reasons. Okay? We have this argument. Okay? Ashkechei Rav Nassim L'Eliyahu Amalei, my ka'avet kutcha brichu fahi shaita. What is God doing at this time when he lost the argument, so to say? Amalei kachayach, he's smiling, va'amar, nitzchuni banai nitzchuni. My children have won, my children have won. Except the word nitzchuni can mean one other thing. What can nitzchuni mean besides winning?
Eternal.
Nitzchuni banai nitzchuni. My children have made me eternal. My children have made me eternal. The minute my children are willing to have skin in the game, skin in the halachic process, that is what's going to guarantee that no matter if there's a crusade or a holocaust or anything else of that nature, no matter what challenge there is in the world, in their personal life or community life, my children will always guarantee the future of the Jewish people because they have skin in the game. Nitzchuni banai nitzchuni. My children have immortalized me. My children have immortalized me. That's the unbelievable peace that needs to be recognized here. That's what Lo Bashamayim he achieves.